In the late 1970s, the song Biko was a haunting eulogy sung by a famous music band, U2, which some of us will remember. It was a eulogy to the South African Steve Biko. In August 1977, he was detained by security police and intensely interrogated. In the process, he suffered a severe head injury. The doctors examined him while he lay naked and chained. They deliberately chose to overlook an obvious head injury. Only after slipping into a semi-conscious state did the police doctor recommend that he be transferred to a hospital immediately. Instead, they drove him 1,200 kilometers to Pretoria, a 12-hour journey or more, while he lay naked in the back of a Land Rover. A few hours after arriving, alone and lying in a prison cell, he died from brain damage. Now, let me ask you, how does that make you feel? Outraged? Sad? How do you respond to such a tragic death? Well, let me tell you how Jimmy Kruger felt. He was the government minister of safety and security at the time. He lied, telling people that Biko died from a hunger strike, and he said that Biko's death, and I quote, left him cold, left him indifferent. Well, it's Good Friday. And in many ways, Jesus' death is tragic. Another innocent man condemned to die. So let me ask you and me, how does the death of Jesus leave you? Cold? Indifferent? Angry? Outraged? Sad? Full of pity? How does Jesus' death make us feel? How do we respond? Well, first up, I'd like us to consider how back then people who were present treated Jesus, how they responded. Well, if you look at the Roman soldiers, how do they treat him? Well, they mock him. The soldiers led Jesus away, verse 16, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They, verse 17, put a purple robe on him. It's a mock robe. He's meant to be king, so let's dress him like one, purple for royalty. It's a mock robe and a mock crown, verse 17. They twist together a crown of thorns and set it on him. They mock him in words, verse 18. They call out, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they mock him in action, verse 19. They hit him and they spit on him and they drop to their knees sarcastically, pretending to worship when they, verse 20, mocked him. Jesus suffers great physical violence, but that is not what Mark focuses on. Instead, he emphasizes Jesus' humiliation, mocked by Roman soldiers, Gentiles. But they're not the only ones, verse 29, because now it's the turn of the Jews, old unbelieving Israel, those who were told in verse 19, not 29, verse 19, those who passed by hurled insults, shaking their heads, saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days? Come down from the cross and save yourself." He's mocked by Roman soldiers and mocked by Jewish passers-by. And then he's mocked by religious leaders. Verse 31. The chief priests and the teachers of the law mock him. He saved others, but he can't save himself. "Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down from the cross, that we may see and believe." It's rich with sarcasm, mocking. And to top it off, he's mocked by terrorists. Now, we've just sung a song that said the thief on the cross, but actually they weren't thieves. They were terrorists. They were people who had sought to overthrow the government of the day. Verse 32, we're told, those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. He's mocked by Gentiles. He's mocked by old unbelieving Israel. Well, what about new Israel? the disciples Jesus personally chose after rejecting old unbelief in Israel? Well, in between these two scenes of mocking, we have verses 20 to 28, which matter-of-factly record the details of the crucifixion. In verse 22, they lead him out to Golgotha, literally the skull, a place familiar with death, the common place for crucifixion. In verse 23, they offer him wine mixed with myrrh, a normal custom, a sort of sedative or anesthetic. In verse 24, they put him on a cross, and they cast lots for his clothes, which was a normal perk for the soldiers who carried out the execution. In verse 25, we're told the time. In verse 26, they fix a charge notice to the cross. Again, the usual practice. And in verse 27, they crucify two others alongside him. Normal procedure. This is a standard execution. Lots of details. But then we've got to ask, well, what about the new Israel? What about Jesus' disciples? Those who promised to follow him, no matter what. Those who swore to take up their cross. Those who declared they were willing to die for him, die with him. Well, verse 21, here's we get some insight. We're told in verse 21, a certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. Now, it's a very matter-of-fact comment, isn't it? But it shouts out, where are the disciples? Where are Jesus' close friends? They are conspicuous in their absence. Instead of them helping Jesus carry the cross, a stranger, someone passing by, is forced to help. Which kind of very subtly and loudly underlines the massive failure of the disciples. They deny Jesus, abandon Jesus. When Jesus needs them most, they're nowhere to be found. Yes, the Gentile Roman soldiers mock Jesus. The Jews as well, passers-by, religious leaders, terrorists, and the disciples, because they run and hide. Mocked and humiliated. But in all this, there is a rich, rich irony. They mock him, pretending that he's a king, robe, crown, sort of bow down. But here's the irony. He is the king. He is the Messiah. They mock him, say, hail. They mock him, sort of, saying, hail, king of the Jews. A sort of messianic title, king of Israel. The irony is, Jesus is the very one who they say he is. The taunts are those scripture predicted. The names called are his true titles. The charge is true. Jesus is the true King of Israel, the Messiah. And it is that which sets Jesus apart from Steve Biko, from you and from me. This is the death of God's only Son. Jesus is unique, and his death is unique. So what is unique about Jesus' death? Well, the key is understanding Jesus' two loud cries on the cross, as well as the two signs that accompany those cries. And that's going to help us to understand and grasp the significance of his death. Well, the first cry follows and is accompanied by a strange and supernatural sign. Verse 33. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. Now, the sixth hour isn't 6 a.m. in the morning. Back then, they would have counted time from sunrise. So it would have been the sixth hour of daytime. That's literally 12 noon. At that hour, in the middle of the day, in the blazing sun, the lights go out. Darkness descends over all of the land for 3 hours. At the birth of God's Son, there is brightness at midnight. At his death, there is darkness at noon. Now, to understand that, we need to understand that in the Old Testament, darkness during daytime symbolized God's wrath and anger. Just listen to these words from the prophet Isaiah, chapter 13. where he says, "See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within it." Now take note. "The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light." Darkness is a symbol, a sign of God's judgment against sin and sinners. And as such, it's a sign of separation from God, which helps us understand Jesus' first cry. Verse 34. "At the ninth hour, Jesus cries out in a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani,' which means, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" Darkness is followed by the cry, the symbol of separation, followed by the cry of separation. Now, don't miss what's going on here. Jesus suffers physical agony, yet his cry is one of spiritual agony. This is not an imagined separation or a felt separation. It is a real separation. It is to be God forsaken. God the Son separated from God the Father. Jesus has suffered at the hands of his foes, the Jewish leaders, the Roman governor, the soldiers, the passerbys, the crowd. Jesus has suffered at the hands of his friends, betrayed by Jesus, deserted by disciples, denied by Peter. But now Jesus suffers at the hands of his Father. But why? Well, that's the very question Jesus asks. Why have you forsaken me? But he's not asking a question that he doesn't know the answer to. It's a rhetorical question. He's quoting a line from Psalm 22. Jesus knows the answer. Though I wonder, do we? Why does God forsake his Son? What is it that separates us from God? Sin. Simple as that. Jesus is God forsaken because he suffers for sin. Not his sin, he's sinless. He suffers for our sin. He takes our punishment in our place. And the Father turns his face away, and the Son suffers God's anger at sin. Now, little boys can get up to a lot of good mischief with a magnifying glass. They can find unsuspecting ants and discover, if they hold it at just the right angle on a hot day, the rays of the sun will be concentrated through that magnifying glass onto one single point, the poor ant. Now God took all his anger at sin, his anger at every sin committed by every person in all places throughout all ages, and God focused his anger at the sins of the whole world onto a single point at a single moment of time, onto his Son at the cross. The sinless Son of God takes upon himself our sin and faces God's wrath. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us. He takes our sin, and in doing so, he is separated from the Father. God forsakes his Son, God forsaken for our sake, for our sin. Well, what about Jesus' second cry, verse 37, which says, "With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last." Now, the original Hebrew phrase, "breathed his last," implies a deliberate death. It's better understood as Jesus gave up his life. It was his choice. The significance of the second loud cry is not what he said, but what he did. He died. He gave himself over to death. He chose death. And the sign which follows explains what his death achieves. Verse 38. Jesus dies, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. On the cross, Jesus dies. And down the road at the temple, the curtain, it's ripped up, literally ripped down. Now, the temple curtain wasn't like the curtains on our windows. It was rather a large, extremely heavy, very thick curtain between the holy place and the Holy of Holies. Now, remember that the temple symbolized God's home. That was the place where God lived. But the Holy of Holies, that was a small room within it, was like God's room, where God dwelt. And the heavy curtain acted as a big no-entry sign. It warned sinful, unholy people of their unfitness to approach a holy God. Only priests were allowed to enter the holy place. And only the high priest was allowed past the temple curtain into the Holy of Holies. And then only once a year. And then only with the blood of sacrifices. And then only for a moment. And then only while walking backwards. Can you see, it all served as a visual aid, showing that sinful people cannot approach a holy God, that sinners and God are separated. So now, when the temple curtain is supernaturally torn in two from top to bottom, it shows us what Jesus' death achieves. Jesus' death rips down sin and removes God's wrath at sin. His death destroys what divides, takes away what separates, and gains access for sinners into the very presence of God. Enemies can now become friends. Rebels can be reconciled. Now, if you want to meet with the Queen of England, you've got to go through a lot of protocol and red tape. I understand, I've never tried it, but I understand you've got to make a request, one of several thousand every day. You've got to fill in an application, motivated with good reason, then be granted an audience, and you have an appointment scheduled. And then, before that, you are duly instructed on how to greet her and treat her and how to generally behave in her presence. There's loads of protocol, red tape. But when it comes to the King of Kings, Jesus' death rips up all protocol. The curtain is torn. We can now walk directly into the very presence of God through Jesus because of his death. It's just enormous. And it's marvelous. The death of Steve Biko, that's a tragedy. But the death of Jesus, that's a triumph. God forsakes his son for our sin. And his son opens the way for sinners to come back to God. And that great truth is underlined surprisingly by the insults hurled at Jesus. You know, passers-by hurled insults in verse 29. In verse 32, it's those who were crucified with him. But in verse 31, we've got the very words with which the religious leaders insulted Jesus. And their insults, again, are full of striking irony. Verse 31, the chief priests mock him. They say, he saved others, but he can't save himself. The irony? He saves others by not saving himself. And they continue, verse 32, let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe. The irony? By not coming down, he makes it possible for them to see and believe. Which all begs the question, do you and I see and believe? What's your response to Jesus and his death? Well, we've heard two cries, we've seen two signs, but there's also two responses to Jesus, and we'll close with this. First, the darkness descends, and Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the response, verse 35, when some of those standing near heard this, they said, listen, he's calling Elijah. One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down. And here's the perfect response of blind confusion. They don't understand. They think he's calling Elijah. They fail to see and believe. And they're not the only ones. I mean, I wonder if perhaps we may be like the Jewish religious leaders, angry at Jesus because you see him as a threat. Is Jesus a threat to you? A threat to living life your own way? A threat to having to change what you think and say and do because he'll be king? Life is neatly worked out the way you want. You've got your own dreams, your own ambitions, your own wants, your own priorities. And Jesus gets in the way. And so he must be kept out of the way. Or perhaps we might be like Pilate. Or we simply choose to ignore the facts. You don't want to be against Jesus, but neither will you stand up for him. It's too much trouble, too much cost. You'd rather please others than have others be against you. Well, I wonder perhaps if we might follow the crowd. Herd instinct, unthinking, go with the flow, easily swayed by others. Your opinion of Jesus is formed by what others say or by what you read others say, not by your own personal serious consideration. Or perhaps we might be a mocker, like the soldiers, the passers-by, and those who die with Christ. You just ridicule Jesus. He's a swear word. Jesus is a joke, comic relief. It's not to be taken seriously. All of those are blind confusion. Well, let's see what the other response is. It's in verse 39. Jesus cries out. He gives up his life. The temple curtain is torn. And then verse 39. When the centurion, a Roman soldier, a Gentile, who stood there in front of Jesus, heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Here is a response which is a confession of faith. It's a believing confession. A Roman centurion of all people sees and believes, recognizes Jesus for who he is, and recognizes Jesus as God. Now, friends, the death of Steve Biko was a tragedy. But your personal response and mine will have little consequence. But the death of Jesus Christ is a triumph, a victory. And our response has eternal consequences. God forsakes his Son so that his Son may welcome us back to God, open the way back to him. And Mark in his gospel, and here's the end of his gospel, wants you and me to consider the evidence. Is Jesus some sort of liar who deceived others into following him? Surely not. Is Jesus a lunatic deserving of our pity and sympathy? Surely not. Is Jesus merely a good man with good moral teachings? Surely not. Surely this man is the Son of God. This Easter, this year, will you see? Will you believe?